Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And happy Independence Day, or 4th of July, whichever you prefer. To mark the date, we have as our guest a 16-year-old high school student whose love of the past changed the course of history. And after that, we'll take a look at another anniversary event, the 100th anniversary of the release of one of the milestones in film history, Edwin S. Porter's The Great Train Robbery. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on July 2, 1839, mutiny broke out on the slave ship Amistad, bound for the sugar plantations of Cuba. The African slave trade had been abolished in the U.S. and Great Britain, but Cuba, still a Spanish possession, continued to transport slaves. The slaves aboard the Amistad attacked the crew with sugar cane knives, killing the captain and one crew member, and seizing control of the ship. They ordered the crew to return them to Africa, but instead, they turned the ship in the direction of the United States. The ship sailed aimlessly for 2 months, but it was finally sighted by the USS Washington in U.S. waters and escorted to New London, Connecticut. The crew was freed, and the Africans imprisoned to await trial for mutiny. The Cubans requested the return of their slaves, and the Spanish demanded their extradition to Cuba for trial on charges of piracy and murder, but American abolitionists demanded that the slaves be returned to Africa. On January 13, 1840, Judge Andrew Judson ruled that the Africans were illegally enslaved and should be returned to Africa. The decision was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, however, where the slaves were defended by John Quincy Adams, who'd returned to the bar after serving as the 6th President of the United States. On March 9, 1841, with only one dissenter, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the slaves, explaining that the Africans had a legal right to fight for their freedom because they'd been illegally captured and enslaved. Most of the Africans returned to Africa, but some, influenced by their friends the abolitionists, went to Sierra Leone, where they founded a Christian mission. This is Talking History.
The shepherd set sail today, set sail today. The captain had the crew in shackles. The edge of the world today, down, down, down. The shepherd set sail today, set sail today.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a nationwide bounty hunt is underway with a $1 million reward. The target is a 90-year-old nickel. After being born of questionable circumstances, five 1913 Liberty Head nickels serviced in the 1920s. Two are in private collections and two are in museums. The whereabouts of the fifth has confounded collectors for at least 40 years, but the Bowers and Marina Galleries of Wolfboro, New Hampshire, hope to change that by offering the $1 million reward. The Liberty Head nickel was minted from 1883 to 1912, when it was replaced by the Indian or Buffalo Head nickel. The five Liberty nickels, however, were minted illegally in 1913, possibly by a mint official. They were never placed into circulation, and for many years they were illegal to own. No set value has been placed on the missing coin, but collectors agree that it's worth more than the $1 million reward. It's hard to believe that an 11-year-old boy could change the course of history, but that is just what happened when Hunter Scott, now 16 and our guest this week, started researching the sinking of the USS Indianapolis on July 30, 1945. Scott tells us his story in conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
What if your middle school history project actually changed history? That's exactly what happened to Hunter Scott. Hunter, now 16, was in the sixth grade when he began researching the tragedy of the USS Indianapolis. 3 years later, he stood in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee and gave testimony that helped clear the name of Charles McVeigh, the ship's captain. Hunter Scott, welcome.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Before we get to your story, perhaps we could begin with the ship itself. What happened to the USS Indianapolis on July 30th, 1945?
Well, the USS Indianapolis was the flagship of the Fifth Fleet, and it had just delivered the first atomic bomb, which was later going to be dropped on Hiroshima. So it was on its way from Guam to Leyte on July 30th, and it was sunk by the Japanese submarine, the I-58, on its way to Leyte for gunnery practice with the USS Idaho. And it turns out that when the ship, the men waited in the water for 4 days and five nights, the Navy completely forgot about them, took them off the plotting board, never reported them overdue, and when they got back, actually court-martialed Captain McVeigh.
So the captain of the ship is court-martialed after the ship sinks. What exactly were the charges against him?
He was charged with failure to follow a zigzag pattern and failure to sound abandoned ship. He was found guilty of failure to follow a zigzag pattern and good visibility. But if you talk to the survivors of the Indianapolis, I've got quotes from them saying that the visibility was poor, that you could not even see your hand in front of you at some point. But when the ship was sunk, the clouds had uncovered the moon for about 15 minutes when the Indianapolis was sunk. And that's when the I-58 sank the Indianapolis.
You were 11 years old when you ran across this story. The sinking, indeed World War II itself, was a long time in the past. How did you run across the story?
Well, between my 5th and 6th grade year, I was going into middle school, and I had the opportunity to participate in History Fair, which is a national competition where kids compete in history to see who has done the most research, and who knows their topic the best and can display it the best. And so I was looking for a topic, and I was watching the movie Jaws one day with my dad, and we came across the story of the Indianapolis. There's a little segment, I don't know if you remember in there, but there's a segment when Captain Quinn and other guys are sitting around the boat discussing scars and shark bites, and that leads into the story of the Indianapolis. So from then I was like, Dad, is this a true story? And he said, I don't know, Hunter, but you're in front of the TV. And he kind of brushed me to the side a little bit. I said, no, you know, this sounds like it could be a good topic for my history fair project. He's like, well, why don't you go to the library and check out a book? Now, he was a middle school principal, actually my middle school principal at the time when I was going to go into sixth grade. So he gave the typical teacher's response, the typical administrator's response, which was to go to the library. So I checked out the book, Fatal Voyage, and that was written by Dan Kurtzman, and I read that book. And then put an ad in the Gosport, which is a local Navy newspaper. And in that article, I asked if anybody had any information on the Indianapolis or where to locate a survivor. And so from then, I found survivor Mr. Maurice Glenn Bell, who lives in Mobile, Alabama. I set up an interview with Mr. Bell, and he gave me a list of all of the other survivors. So from that list, I was able to contact 156 of the remaining survivors, which was all of them at the time.
Is Captain McVeigh himself still alive?
He is not. He committed suicide in 1968 because of what the Navy had done to him. I mean, they just completely made him the scapegoat to cover up for their naval blunders, or to cover up for their mistakes.
The 156 survivors that you talked to, were they eager to talk to you? Or, you know, we sometimes hear of World War II veterans who are reluctant to tell their stories. What reaction did you get?
I came across a mixture of both, but mostly the men of the Indianapolis were willing to talk to me, and a lot of them opened up for the first time to talk to me and to tell me their side of the story. So I got 156 different sides of the story, but all of them agreed in one area, and that was that Captain McVeigh should not have been court-martialed, that the Navy court-martialed Captain McVeigh, hung him out to dry to cover up for their mistakes during World War II. But for a lot of men, that was the first time that they had actually opened up and told their story.
What was the reaction talking to someone of your age? I'm curious.
I mean, it's just a lot of them, most of them were more than happy to talk to me and more than happy to get the story out, because these men want as many people to know about the Indianapolis as possible, because it was covered up so much. In 1945, when the war came to an end, there was big headlines, Japan surrenders, end of war, at the top of every page, every newspaper across the across the country and some even over the world, and yet underneath was a small article about the Indianapolis and the loss of so many lives. So the Navy tried real hard, and as a matter of fact, when I went to the library to do research on the Indianapolis, I found very little information written in some of the major World War history books. And that was because the Navy tried to cover it up. So many of the men were more than happy to tell their story.
What specifically did they recall about Captain McVeigh and particularly the time of the sinking?
Every one of them, it was almost unanimous that everyone said they were in love with Captain McVeigh, that even if they had to go sail again today, that they would take Captain McVeigh as their captain. So there was, all the survivors were behind Captain McVeigh 100% and felt that he should not have been court-martialed.
So you took the information that they gave you, and perhaps you could describe for us how you turned it into the History Fair project.
Well, what I did was, once Mr. Bell gave me the list of the 156 survivors, I contacted all of those men and gathered research from really all over the world, some of the survivors, and they would just send in old newspaper articles and pictures and first-hand primary documents and their accounts that they had written right after the sinking, when some of them when they were even in the hospital. And so once I got all this, actually people even saw me on news shows such as NBC Nightly News and TNN Primetime Country. And as a matter of fact, Captain McVeigh's son, Kimo McVeigh, saw me on TNN Primetime Country and actually called the studio, and that's how I first got in touch with him. So I have a ton of information coming from all over the country. And so from that point, I picked out some of the most interesting things and put them on a display board so that I could display it to the judges at the History Fair.
Now, I've been a judge myself at History Fairs or History Day competitions for middle school and high school students. This sounds like a sure winner. I assume you did well.
Actually, I did, up until the state. I got first at the school competition, and I was the first sixth grader to ever win the county competition. And at the state, I was disqualified for displaying two notebooks by my project, which I asked the History Fair coordinator for our county, should I display the notebooks or not, because they were, I mean, two, three, four-inch thick notebooks full of firsthand accounts and newspaper articles from the time and just primary sources, and she said definitely. And so I was also given an old copy of the rule book, which didn't mention anything about it. So I was like, all right, well, I'll put these projects by my notebooks. Put these notebooks by my project. I think that it'll help me out. And when they were done judging, they took a big section of the rule board and the rule book and blew it up real big and highlighted the part where it says no notebooks shall be displayed by your project or something to that effect. I don't remember exactly what it said. So I was disqualified from the state competition.
Now, in most cases, I dare say that would be the end of the story, but in a sense, that's really just the beginning of yours. What did you do with the information that you gathered after the History Fair was over?
Well, from that point, I was hoping to restore honor to the Indianapolis survivors by clearing Captain McVeigh's name and trying to get them a presidential unit citation. I was trying to do that by winning the National History Fair and draw media attention to my project, but it turns out I'm a strong Christian, that the Lord had other plans for me. And so I talked with a good friend of mine who is our congressman, Congressman Scarborough, and I displayed my project in his office here in Pensacola. And people were just coming in and just lining up outside of his door so they could come in and take a look at the information that I had accumulated and compiled about the Indianapolis. So he's like, Hunter, man, you gotta come in my office and tell me what's going on with this. So I went in his office, and he agreed with me that we need to do something to help restore honor to Captain McVeigh. So we drafted legislation, and the first legislation we drafted was a bill, H.R. 3710. And I personally got to drop that in the hopper on the House, which was a great experience. And what the bill would have done if passed is it would have erased the court-martial from Captain McVeigh's record and granted a presidential unit citation to the final crew of the Indianapolis. But it turns out that that legislation ended with the congressional session. So instead, we introduced a joint resolution in the House and the Senate, and it ended up being attached to the Armed Services Appropriation Measure and passed. I mean, the Navy wasn't going to fight it if it was attached to their budget, so there really was not a whole lot the Navy could do about it from then on. So the legislation passed, and it's on Captain McVeigh's record right now that Captain McVeigh should not have been court-martialed and that he was not responsible for the loss of the Indianapolis and her crew.
Sounds like you're not only a skilled historian, but a skilled politician as well.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate it.
You've mentioned already the efforts of your congressman. You also wrote to President Clinton and to the Secretary of the Navy before the legislation passed. I'm curious, what did you say to the President and to the Naval Secretary, and how did they respond?
Well, I wrote them originally asking for a presidential pardon for Captain McVeigh or for them to reopen the court-martial, but I soon discovered that Captain McVeigh did not do anything wrong to receive a pardon, and both Secretary of the Navy John Dalton and President Clinton responded with very stern, but, I mean, they were nice, no letters saying that that they've looked into the matter and Captain McVeigh's court-martial would not be reopened. So, I mean, I didn't let that stop me. I just said, well, I guess now that I look back on it, a letter from the president isn't going to stop me.
Most people don't get letters from the president for that matter. You also testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. What was that experience like? What did you tell them?
Oh, that was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me to testify in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee. It was chaired by Senator Warner at the time, and Senator Smith, who has been a tremendous help on the Senate side with the legislation, he got the survivors and I in for a hearing with the Armed Services Committee. So there was me and three other survivors on one side of the room, and then on the other side of the room we sat the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, and the Chief Naval Historian. And then their entourage of people behind them just taking notes the entire time. I think that the Navy left there with the tail between their legs. I mean, no offense to the Navy, but the survivors and I just completely gave the Navy what they didn't expect. The Navy had refused to look at my research, and I'd given them the opportunity to look at it ample times, but they said no. So when we presented it to them, they didn't know how to respond to the questions that the survivors and I asked to them.
Well, as I recall, it's not just a figurative thing. You literally gave, was it the Secretary of the Navy, your material?
Yes, sir, I did. I handed it to him personally. So I don't know if they looked at it or not.
As I recall, he's a PhD from somewhere, isn't he?
Yes, I believe so. I'm not exactly sure on that.
And you were 14 years old at the time, informing him. So in the end, after the president and the naval secretaries and the senator involved, the result is that Captain McVeigh's name, after what, some 50 years or more, is finally cleared.
Yes, sir. Which that was my goal all along, is to restore honor to these group of survivors, these group of World War II veterans who served aboard the Indianapolis, just to restore honor to that group, and which Tom Brokaw calls the greatest generation. And so that's what I was trying to do, was restore honor to those men and restore honor to Captain McVeigh and the McVeigh family by exonerating him and clearing his name. And it was finally accomplished.
You have another life, too. You're, a junior in high school, I
yes.
believe? What are your future plans? Going to college?
Well, today was the last day of school, finally.
Congratulations.
So I'm excited about that. And over the summer, I just plan to do a little fishing. A couple of weeks ago, as a matter of fact, me and a friend of mine caught a 200-pound bull shark off the beach. And so that was a great experience. And as far as college goes, I guess that's my summer job over the summer, is trying to get into colleges and filling out applications for scholarships and college applications, and that's pretty much going to take up my whole summer.
Well, best of luck to you, Hunter.
Well, thanks.
Appreciate your being with us.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed it as well. I appreciate you having me on the show.
I've been visiting with Hunter Scott, whose story has been told by Pete Nelson in the book Left for Dead, A Young Man's Search for Justice for the USS Indianapolis, published by Delacorte Press.
Every July 4th, we celebrate the founding of the United States of America. For our site of the week, for our celebration of the nation's founding, we thought we would tell you about a site on the Internet that has the most extensive set of data on the nation you will find anywhere. It's the U.S. Historical Census Data Browser. And here to tell you about it is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
According to the 1790 census, how many families held 2 to 4 slaves? How many more than 300? What percent of white females attended school in 1850? How did literacy rates compare for native-born whites and African-Americans in the 19th and 20th centuries? How many farms were operated by cash tenants versus share cash tenants versus croppers in 1920? This website allows you to quickly locate, graph, and chart the answers to these questions and many more by providing access to data gathered by the Inter-University Consortium for Political and Social Research from census records and other government sources for a study entitled Historical Demographic, Economic, and Social Data, the United States, 1790 to 1970. For each decade, browse extensive population and statistical information at state and county levels. It is arranged according to a variety of categories, including place of birth, age, gender, marital status, race, education, illiteracy, salary, housing, and specifics of agriculture, labor, and manufacturing. Select up to 15 variables for each search, and the results are displayed as both raw figures and statistical charts. Run comparisons among the selected categories to calculate percentages and relationships among data. Census data across almost two centuries is inherently problematic, as discussed in the introductory essay. Categories are inconsistent between census periods and even within particular periods. Standards for collecting data and the role of census takers changed dramatically. Studying these changes alone could be an enormous and rewarding project. This is a fabulous resource, an easy-to-use introduction to census data and historical statistics. To locate this site, go to historymatters.gmu.edu. Type census browser into the keyword search.
100 years ago, one of the great films in motion picture history came to the screen, Edward S. Porter's The Great Train Robbery. Compared to today's movies, it is a simple film, but for its time, argues Virginia Wexman, it was a pioneering work in technical innovations, creating a cinematic model for decades to come. Virginia Wexman is a professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where she teaches film and cultural studies. She's also the editor of Film and Authorship, published by Rutgers University Press.
First released in 1903, Edwin S. Porter's The Great Train Robbery tells a simple tale of a group of bandits who rob a moving train and escape into the countryside. A posse soon pursues them, and a climactic shootout ensues. The Great Train Robbery captured public attention from its first showing and quickly took its place as a milestone in film history. It's honored as the work that set the pattern of crime, pursuit, and retribution that came to define the Western film genre. More broadly, as film historian Robert Sklar observed, The Great Train Robbery was the first film to unite motion picture spectacle with myth and stories about America that were shared by people throughout the world. Porter's film succeeded in part because its plot cannily exploited cultural currents of the time. It played on the public's fascination with actual robberies taking place on the frontier. The movie was advertised as a production posed and acted in faithful duplication of the genuine holdups made famous by various outlaw bands in the Far West. The Great Train Robbery was also crafted as a variation on the genre of the railway movie, in which movement and the technological wonders of the modern world played a central role. Finally, Porter's film concluded with a rousing chase sequence, which became a model for action films from that time forward. Great Train Robbery's significance in film history arises not just from its innovative and culturally resonant storytelling, but also from the technical innovations it pioneered. Many of the movie's scenes were photographed out of doors, and the camera moves freely to cover fast-moving action. In one scene, a frightened passenger, attempting to escape from the bandits, runs wildly toward the camera, rather than exiting the frame off to the side, as he would have done had he followed the more theatrically oriented convention that had been standard practice up to that time. The film's editing, too, is remarkable. As the story unfolds, suspense is heightened by the portrayal of simultaneous actions occurring in various locales. For example, as the bandits make off with the loot, we see the station master alerting the sheriff about the robbery. Porter does not yet fully understand the potential of the kind of extensive cross-cutting later perfected in D.W. Griffith's famous Rides to the Rescue, but The Great Train Robbery pointed the way to this quintessentially cinematic mode of storytelling. Finally, Porter's film included a striking close-up, a most unusual kind of shot for 1903. This close-up, which was to be inserted at either the beginning or the end of the story, showed a bandit shooting his gun directly at the camera. The intense emotional jolt communicated by this shot dramatically illustrated the potency of close-up photography to audiences and filmmakers alike. Like so many of the other features of the Great Train Robbery, the lesson taught by this new technique soon became a cinematic commonplace, taking its place as part of the grammar of the movies as we know them today.
You've been listening to Virginia Wexman, professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and the author of Film and Authorship. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. Our Site of the Week segment was produced by Amanda Schumann of George Mason University Center for History and New Media. And this is your host, Brian LeBeau, ending this special Independence Day show with a reading of part of the Declaration of Independence by producer, director, actor George Flynn from his CD, Words of Freedom, Men of Honor. Have a nice week.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government. Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable.